right now.
Do we want to move that closer to Vernon?
Yeah, well.
No, I think you can pick it up from here. I got two mics and it's recording about everything. You won't need to, I think it'll pick up just about.
Gentleman that we have asked to speak for the first time to the Historical Society is Vern Robinson, who has been in Alaska since 1939. You came before the war.
Yes.
Could you speak a little bit louder? It's good, okay. You came in 1939?
Yes, I landed here September 18th, 1939. I came out here as Deputy United States Marshal.
As a Deputy Marshal. And was there buildings around here by the Air Force?
Yes, there's a... I have an old calendar that has a picture of Unalaska in its early days. And then I have a calendar that was a picture that was taken recently showing improvements. Mm-hmm. And the Army has made the big improvements here.
Yes, I imagine they did.
So we can call that progress, I guess.
What's the population?
Roughly 250. I wasn't aware of the purpose of this organization when I was invited here, so it would be probably impossible to get up some kind of a talk that I was asked to do, so I'd like to leave it in questions and answers, and I'll try to give an intelligent answer to any of your questions.
Very good. We have a lot of people around here to ask you questions.
Father?
Yes. When the soldiers came in, I mean, this is my part, when the people came over here and they asked our people to leave, now, who was left here then?
There were three or four Aleuts. There were probably half a dozen whites. There were probably 2,000 civilian workmen working for Sim Drake Puget Sound Company, and there were 65,000 military. That would be composed of the sailors and soldiers and CBs and Marines and all phases of the military activities. Roughly 65,000 people. That's a lot of people. It's a big city.
You were hired as a marshal to come out here?
Yes, sir.
Why did they need a marshal here?
Well, they had, in 1903, the marshal's office was established by, I'm not sure, I don't remember the judge's name, but they had a floating court, and they determined that it's a good place to have a station. So they established the station in 1903. And in 1952, they felt that it was not necessary to have the station any longer, and I recommended that they close it. And they wanted to move me into Anchorage, and I couldn't see moving here. I like the country. to leave here.
At the time of your arrival, what was the economic base, the purpose of this town?
Well, they had mainly worked on the Pribilof Islands. They had worked in Falls Pass and King Cove, and it was seasonal. And then they had the what they call rocking chair pay, and they'd live on mainly on relief. Or it wasn't relief then, it was, what do you call it? They call it rocking chair pay. Then, of course, they had industry here, amounting to roughly $5 million in the fur, the blue fox fur industry. Then they had the sheep industry, that is, there was the Unalaska, or the Alaska Trading Company, that's
Alaska
Livestock and Trading Company, and then Bishop had a ranch on Nikolsky, or they call it Menomnek. And then lately they started a sheep ranch on Umnak, that's on the west end of Umnak Island. And then recently there was, the most recent was this move to establish their sheep ranch and cattle ranch on the west end of Unalaska Island. And that brings to mind the efforts of some of the people that have tried to get some of the finest grazing land in the world out of the Aleutian bird refuge. And they restore it to public domain so they could establish the farms, not only sheep and cattle, but reestablish the fur farm industry that was thriving at the time I came here. And there are some islands out west here that are very suitable for grazing purposes. One is Tanaga Island, one is Kanaga Island, another is Atka Island. Yes?
Do you know anything about the early ranching on either Tanaga or Kanaga Island? There was a ranch there at one time.
Yes, I do. In fact, they tried to introduce Angora sheep on Kanaga Island, and since it was under the direction of the bird refuge, they made them take the sheep off of the island, and they were leasing the island from this Alaska, I forget the name of the outfit, it was a federal agency that leased these islands to the fur farmers, and it was an annual lease that didn't permit the leasee to develop the thing properly. Mm-hmm. That is, he wouldn't go to the trouble of really putting on sheep and cattle and mink and anything but fox that was proven good. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to venture any risk capital. And the result was it was dormant and it eventually died. And then through their interference and direction, why they actually killed the industry. And the industry today is dead, but it could be revived. It has a wonderful possibility.
Were there other villages on Unalaska Island when you came?
Not on Unalaska. Oh, yes. I'll take that back. At Kashiga, Makushin, Borka is not on Unalaska Island, but it's on Sedanka Island, very close to Unalaska. And Unalaska was their port of entry and embarkation.
Was there much communication between Sonewanska? Were you able to visit these other villages while you were?
Well, I had a boat of my own, and then I could travel on what they call a mail boat. It was the old Fern, and then later renamed the Mason. And then I traveled a great deal by the military. In fact, I traveled, I guess, any way that they had known. I traveled on submarines, and I traveled in PBYs, and I traveled on, at that time, the four-motored DC-6, I guess, was the most recent, and it was all military, but I did get around. I traveled on, I forget the name of the vessel, from Kodiak to here, and Charleston. It was a new vessel that was Navy. Yes, Bonnie.
How about the skimboat?
No, I've always wanted to get in a kayak or a umiak and try it out, but I never had the opportunity. I was going to get one time from Arthur Mikano, and the military got it. They got it.
I was in Anchorage and Clyde Latimer, who was here in 1960. And then he made a trip in that with the people to Nikolsky. So it was really, really something strange to hear that.
No, I never was in 1960 there was modern transportation. Probably back in 1916.
Oh, this is 1960 when you said. Yeah. He made a travel with five people in the boat.
In 1960, I was going out to investigate a murder in Nikolsky, a reported murder, and my boat broke down, and I had the vessel that the Baird used in the Antarctic, and I asked them to ask them for assistance, and they were up at St. Paul Island. And I got underway and got into safe port. So they came down and I told them that I was in Chernovsky Harbor in safe port, but they came down anyway. And I had this reported murder to investigate. So I took this vessel, the Coast Guard vessel, out to Nikolsky and find it was more or less a drunken scare, but I had my son with me, and he was all over that vessel, and I was filthy. I was all full of grease and dirt, and they had me dolled up in an Army or a Navy uniform, and then it was a vessel that Baird used in the Antarctic, and Billy told his class in school about his trip on this thing. I guess he's the first kid that ever been aboard a Coast Guard vessel.
How long did you work for the U.S. Marshal's office?
15 years.
Did the government play a big role out here before the war?
Oh yes, I was sent out here primarily to by the Germans, and then since we had trouble with the Japanese, why I was supposed to dig those out, and of course I did work for the Federal Bureau of Investigation as well as the Department of Justice, and in fact we were charged with the duties of all law enforcement, so I guess that took in quite a bit of territory. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful experience. I don't think I'd ever want to do it again. But
you said we, more than one person was working here for the government then?
Oh, I had deputies, and I was under the direction of the United States Marshal at Anchorage. And first it was Valdez, and then they moved the office from Valdez to Anchorage.
At this time, what were some of the businesses operating here?
Oh, there was the Northern Commercial, an Alaska Commercial Company, I should say, when I first came here. And the Alaska Commercial Company was probably part of the Northern Commercial Company. As I understand it, it was just a different set of books. And the Alaska Commercial Company was one that would have a historical bearing on Alaska, because they were the ones that took over from the Russian American Company. They bought their holdings. And I had Johnny Yetsmanov, whose father, Alexei Yetsmanov, was chief at that time, before his death. And during his regime as chief of this village, he recorded a great deal that went on. And one of the things that Johnny told me, that's the son of Alexei Yetsmanov, was that the establishment of the church, now you'd be interested in this, Father, where they contracted to build a church, and I don't remember what figure they named in the contract, but according to Johnny and his father's, his father told him, they paid somewhere around $5 million for the church in fur and in kind, and not in money or anything like that, but they go out and trap fox and go get sea otter, and they'd get a stack of fur up to the top of a long-tom shotgun and maybe give them $10 or $15 for it. Maybe that was a good price, I don't know, of course, in a day's figures, but in Alexei Yetsmanov's figures, he thought that they had paid some $5 million for the church through the Alaska Commercial Company. So I can't question the validity of the story or not, but that's what John Yetsmanov told me. And that's probably the history that has never been written in this part of the country. And I'm sorry that I didn't pay more attention to these stories and write them down and not depend on memory alone to record it.
We never think what the future brings.
What year was that this commercial company was building this church that they charged them with?
I'm not sure, Father, what year it was that they built the church. That should be a matter of record in the church.
How strong was the tribe? And you say this man was the chief. How strong was the tribe, the chief influence over the community at the time?
Well, his word was pretty much law. He was a very respected person. He was a very intelligent person. Even today, he's recognized and remembered as a very intelligent person. Unfortunately, I wasn't able, I didn't know him. He was dead before I got here. But I knew his son, and I listened to a great many of the stories that Jerome and Chief Alex say. And you asked about the influence that the chief had on the village. They were very, I'd say, communistic. They'd work together as a group, and there didn't seem to be any organization to it, but they still worked together. Mm-hmm. In fact, if they wanted to build a fence, why they build a fence. And in particular, I noticed this in Akutan, where they had a glass, human glass was cheap. And they have a dam for a water system as well as their lights there. And I run a mail boat at the time. I had a contract with the United States Post Office Department to take the mail to Akutan once a month, as well as McCoskey. And the whole village was up on the hill working. And finally there was a couple of kids come out to the boat to get the mail. And I asked them what they were doing up there. They said they were building a new dam. The whole village, it turned out, they were all up there working. Some were drinking coffee and some were working, and that's an example of what we have here.
But the Aleuts had a very good law among themselves. They were very beautifully organized community life.
Was this still, this condition still exists when you arrived?
Oh, yes. What I told you, I observed in that town. And when it had deteriorated a great deal, too.
When did Alexei Yachinov die?
I think about 1938. I'm not sure. It should be a matter of record in the church.
When the military came in to build all this stuff, what happened to the village? I mean,
what
did the people do? Did they work for them?
Well, when the Japs bombed the place, they evacuated most of the civilian population. And they took them down into Burnett Inlet, southeast Alaska, and there was one other place, Excursion Inlet. And then they brought them back in 1945, well after the
now you
end of the war.
Now, you stayed here during the war, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
Is
yes,
there
I,
anyone else here on the island that also was here during the war?
Well, I think Henry Swanson was here. Mm-hmm. Yes, Henry was here. And he ran a boat for the Army Transport Service. And then there was Art Harris. I don't know of any other people living that
was Agnes here?
Agnes. No, no, she was evacuated.
Agnes Shaggy?
This is what Anthesia, I mean, this is what I got from her. She shafted off and passed away just a year ago from this month. That when they came back, they found a lot of her things in her home was taken. Upset them very much.
Well, that was one of the bad things about evacuating the people here. I felt a great responsibility since I represented the law at the time, and I'd see a place broken into and ransacked, so I'd board it up. And I'd see another place that needed boarding up, so I figured, well, I'd do that tomorrow. I didn't have time to do it today, but the very place that I boarded up was again torn open, and the place that I left open was not molested at all. But every place, regardless of any other, didn't make any difference what it was. If it was uninhabited, it was broken in by the military, and if there was anything of any value, they'd take. And if they didn't want anything, why, they'd probably destroy it. And these people came back to that mess. So in order to compensate them for what they had lost, they took their word for inventory of what they had when they left here. And Fred Giesling was what they call a resettlement officer. And he was supposed to be in charge of getting this data together to reimburse these people for what they had lost. And he then had to leave and Then I was appointed as resettlement officer for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to receive this stuff and distribute it. And there was a great deal of food set up, clothing, and rugs and shotguns and whatever they would name that they had lost. And when they left here, you got to bear in mind that they were told to take only one suitcase, and that was their limit. And so they left most of the stuff behind. And they were hurt. But on top of that, the Army moved the cabanas they're now living in on their sites and gave them the building. And they were much superior to what they had. And some of them made some real nice houses out of them. And there were several of the natives that did make some remarkable homes out for themselves. So during the time I was resettlement officer, I distributed whatever they brought up. But I had manifests indicating that there was a great pile of stuff that should be distributed, but I never did see it. I never got it. I got some stuff, but not very much. And I don't know where, to this day, I don't know where it all went to, because I wrote to the, I don't remember the name of the guy that dispatched this to me, but I never did hear from him. So, I don't know what happened to the material that they were supposed to get.
One thing which they were not able to replace, this which has hurt them very much, see, they were able to get some icons which were very precious from the old country, and these were not replaced. They were just lost.
There were not very many icons. In fact, samovars, icons, anything pertaining to history, or their religion, it was pretty well dissipated. There weren't very many left. There were some people that left here with a great hoard of that stuff. Mr. R.B. Patterson is a man that had a bar. He had a big collection of the icons, probably very valuable. And then another man who was United States Marshal, he was Deputy United States Marshal in Kodiak, and then eventually United States Marshal in Anchorage, had icons that were listed in a book of icons. And I don't know what happened to those, but I did see his collection of icons, and I also saw and read about them in this book that he had. Now, samovars, there was only one that I ever saw here, and I don't know what ever happened to that. I'd like to pass it myself.
Well, what was the name of that marshal that you said had all these icons? What was the name of that marshal?
Paul Herring.
Paul Herring.
Yeah. The big eucovitreous fish.
The which?
We call him the big eucovitreous fish.
It sounds like something else. But then, would you say then he got these from personal homes then?
No, he got them from people that maybe wanted to sell them or...
I'm awfully sorry. Ladies will not sell their icons.
Well,
then someone who took it and gave it, you know, mm-hmm. picked it up, and then they got it.
Well, that's quite possible.
Yes.
I didn't know, because that was like prior to my time.
Right.
What you're saying, Vern, though, is that these fellows had these collections of things before the military came in and
oh, yes.
all
yes.
It wasn't as a result of the military thing.
In fact, the military, I don't think, got any kind of icon or anything.
What's an icon?
Well, an icon is painted and
yes,
quite valuable. There's maybe Father has some, but
you can come to the church, I'll show.
there's a good collection of them in the church here, and they're very beautiful.
By famous artists? Or?
Sir?
Is it by famous artists?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, there's some very famous artists that contributed to that kind of.
Another question. When the military moved out, what did they do? Did they just destroy everything that they had here, or what?
Oh, yes, they did. In fact, there was what they called a sub-base, and this was a big plant that they were able to repair submarines. They could charge their batteries.
Is that over they here?
Could, yes, that's a big battery, a big outfit by Vita. They had a power plant there, and they had a great deal of stuff. But they moved everything out, and they had five barges loaded with this material. And there was a storm running. I knew this captain of one of the tugs. I don't remember his name, but he was told to take this tow out of the harbor and proceed to Adak. And this guy said, well, he can't go out now. He said, this would be murder. He said, he'd lose the tow, and he said, maybe lose the vessel. And the captain or whoever it was that was directing or made this directive said, you either go or we'll get somebody else to take your place. So he took off, and of course he lost the barge. All the barges were lost. There was nothing to survive. Now I don't know whether it was intentional or what it was, but anyway, great value was lost there because there was a lot of stuff on the barges that were very valuable. Machinery, lathes, delicate machinery. So anyway, that was the only thing that was lost.
Everybody has their own stories about Alaska, but I've heard that there are places that the military just bulldozed motorcycles underneath the ground and buried many, many things after or before their life.
Well, it's UMNAC now. That held very true, and recently they dug a DA cat out of the mud over there. A few days they had it running, so I guess it was probably pretty good shape yet. And there were several vehicles unearthed there. And they did. They buried a lot of stuff here. But they took most of the stuff out by barge and jettisoned it in 1,000 fathoms, especially ammunition. And then they had a demolition crew come up to destroy the bombs and whatever explosives they had here that were considered dangerous. Well, I was sitting talking to my wife, leaning back against the wall and in my chair, and all of a sudden, like a truck hit me in the back, and I lit on the floor. And then a few seconds where there was this great enormous bang. And what happened, I learned later, was that they heaped all this junk up in one big pile and touched it all off in one crack. And that's what did like a well, then they tried to get, recently they tried to get some water over to buy the foods. Asked me what the matter was. You couldn't pipe 10 inches of water in one end of the line and it doesn't get much out of the other end. I said, I told him about what happened and this great bang and this pipeline was laid over near the thing, and of course the windows of all the barracks, in fact there were three barracks, completely destroyed, and the windows out of within a half a mile around was shattered. Are gone, and the pipe eventually must have been pretty badly damaged because water would run through it, run out of it all right. But up through it. And so I recommended that he cross over there by the sub base and have a new line and probably go around that portion that had been near the exploded. But getting back to destruction of things, I was appointed Red Cross representative here, and I had quite a bit of material on hand that was supposed to be for emergency purposes. And people come back here and they went into their homes and they found this terrible mess. And I had all these blankets and cots and stuff. And so I asked the Red Cross representative over at Dutch Harbor what could be done with this stuff, if I could give it to these people that needed it. No, he said, that's only in case of disaster. I said, well, I've never seen such a disaster. I said, this is the worst I've ever seen. So since I was forbidden to distribute the stuff, I said, well, okay, you come over and steal it. I said, the door's unlocked. You cut this out. So the whole works went out. But then lately, or after that, I didn't feel so bad about it, but the military took 4 or 5 truckloads of Red Cross things that maybe my mother needed, a scarf or a pair of gloves or a pair of socks or a sweater or something like that. And they took 3 or 4 truckloads out and burned it. So I didn't feel too bad about giving it.
Military is very wasteful.
Any more questions?
Yes. I understand that Mr. Harris, who was here, tried to get some of these buildings for the good of the community. Why did that fail? After the army has been gone, the military has been gone so long, they wouldn't let them make use of these facilities.
Well, I don't know what they tried to get, but anything was available to anybody that wanted it that could use it. And they had a detachment of Marines for roughly 8 years after the military left here to, I guess, protect whatever was left here. And I know one time there, a guy came over and said, well, you know, the Marines, all they do is break in these buildings. They had them boarded up. Henry Swanson was on a detail that boarded them up. They'd break the doors open and they'd get a whole armful of rocks and they'd go inside of the building and bust the windows out because they were boarded up from the outside. And the boys were having fun, I guess. But anyone that wanted material or a building, there was nobody to stop them. In fact, they were invited to go and get them. In fact, Jeb Caldwell was one of the people that came here over 1951 or 2, and he got sanctioned from the Interior Department to for anybody to help themselves to any building that they wanted on this side of the island, or on the Alaska side. So the military had abandoned the buildings. They were anybody's property that wanted them. And I guess that holds true today, that any military on the public domain would be available to anyone that wants it. So if you feel like you want a building, go and swipe one.
How long did it take to build all these buildings? When did they start?
Well, that was the Sims Rigby Sound Company. They started, they made the preliminary survey in 1940 and 41. And they started building in 40. And they built mostly on Dutch Harbor Island.
That was the first part they built on Dutch Harbor?
Yes. And Fort Mears was wrote over by Agnes Beach, or no. Margaret Bay. And that was heavily hit by the Japanese when they bombed that, six o'clock that morning on the 7th of December.
I guess I hate to be Margaret Bay. Where's Margaret Bay?
That's right across from Panalaska, just west of Panalaska.
Did that man made that Margaret Bay run?
Sure.
Did the military make that?
Oh, no. No.
It's already
there's a lot of history there, too. But getting back to the subject, when the Japs bombed Fort Mears, that was where the majority of the deaths occurred. They hit a mess hall, and the lieutenant, instead of telling them to get in shelter, why, he told them to fall in, and unfortunately a Jap bomb landed close by and killed quite a number of people. And they had set fire to quite a few buildings then. So I was fortunate in having a fair camera. It was not expensive, but it took good pictures. And I got some of the scoops of the war, and then I was also representative of the International News Service. And I was unable to use the material that I had, but I had a scoop, though. I really had one. And there was a guy by the name of Roundtree that he was, when I reported to in Seattle, and I sent him all this stuff by my wife, who was evacuated with that one over there. And
you had a lot of different hats.
That's right, I was really a busy person. But I had the cooperation of the Army, the military, and I had very little trouble. In fact, I got a citation that I did a fair job. So I guess it's one of the experiences a person has. I don't think I'd ever want to do it again, but I sure wouldn't want to miss the chance at it. That I had. It was a wonderful experience.
Have you read the House of Mile War?
Yes.
Do you consider it accurate?
No.
That's what I was wondering.
In what way?
Well, they say they bombed the church, and that is so. The only building that was hit in Unalaska was the hospital. I have pictures of that. And
did it destroy the hospital?
No, it destroyed one portion of it, the east end of it. And there was a nurse down on the lower stairs, and then there was a bomb shelter near the hospital. And these people told me when they were sitting in this thing and they were listening to all this noise, and all of a sudden the top of this thing went up and then settled back down, and all this garbage rained down on them. And that was their experience. And then this nurse was knocked down. That was going down from the upper floor down to the basement.
Mm. No one was killed then?
No, unfortunately, no one was killed on this side. Mm. There was a soldier hit. They evacuated the bomb or the anti-aircraft on top of haystack. That was very effective, and put it up above Unalaska. And at that time, there were no buildings up in the valley here. Mm-hmm. And they strafed and hit one of the soldiers in this gun emplacement. Mm-hmm. And they were effective with good crew. I mean, they really put him in there and steered the Japs away. A lot of pieces fell out of one of the Jap planes, but I never did see one come down.
I've heard there's an old hospital out in the hill somewhere, way inside, all concrete. I don't know if it's true or not.
There were no buildings on this side until after the raid, and then they called in a specialist that told them to houses up on top of the mountains and various places like that. Mm-hmm.
Do you know about the ship that went down? It's up in there, Captain's Bay, is that it? The ship that's down.
Well, yeah, I ought to know about that ship. I came to the country in 1920 in that boat.
In 1920?
That was the Northwestern.
Huh.
And it was towed from Anchorage to show to President Roosevelt. And of course, President Roosevelt didn't come in. He gets to change his mind, and he was put by here in a destroyer. So they towed it back out. No, they thought and they'd fill it full of scrap and tow it to the States and use it for making bombs or something. And they loaded, I got a good marine engine on that thing someplace. They sure cleaned up. They got thousands of tons of scrap in the thing. So they towed it out to the head of Captain's Bay where there was fair shelter, and it was uncared for, and it eventually sank where it is now. Unfortunately, that was a very nice ship.
You mean it wasn't bound in at all? It just of its own.
Oh yes, they were using it for before it was towed out there, and they wanted to show it to President Roosevelt. That was hit on the second day that the Japs bombed the place. That was 6 o'clock on the following day, on the 8th, and they burned it badly. The upper structure was badly burned. And 3 days after the fire, they put the thing out. And 3 days after the fire, they restored the electrical system and boilers, and they were generating power. And that was prior to the time they had the big generating plant at Dutch Harbor.
They used it for power then.
Oh yes,
mm-hmm.
They use it for power as well as heating facilities and living quarters for the Tim Drake 2000 man.
I see.
Were those the only 2 days that either Dutch or Onalaska were bombed?
That's right.
There's
yeah.
No other time.
Yeah. Well, there was a detachment. A flight of planes came in at noon on the first day of bombing, and that gun emplacement on top of Haystack evidently put some shot right amongst them, and they dispersed them over in the Cushing Valley, and they didn't bomb any more around here or on the last Dutch Harbor either.
Just the furthest east that the Japs got from bombing, or did they go beyond?
What furthest on record? There were some boats piled up at Sand Point, and it was just through carelessness. But west of here, they sank a submarine, destroyer got it, and then they had a bunch of bombers at Umneck. They were just building that field there, but they had 17 bombers there. And they found one of these carriers, I think it was Colonel Lipsy, that was pilot of this PBY that saw this submarine. And he radioed in the position, and I understand that they asked the CO at Umneck to send out the bombers to bomb the Japs, and they were told that they knew as they pleased that they weren't under the direction of the military or the Navy. It was just a friction between Army and Navy, so they evidently didn't probably could have. But of course, that could have been the story too. No one knows. That's unrecorded history.
Getting off the subject a little bit, all of these villages where the Aleuts lived around Unalaska, did they move to Unalaska, or they're not living there now?
They all came into Unalaska. There were some of them that went to Akutan. Cooters went to Akutan. Mm-hmm. And most of the Borka people came in here.
Mm-hmm.
Chernovsky and Kashiga came to Unalaska.
Mm-hmm.
As well as Kushkar. Yeah, McCushka.
Mm-hmm.
Were there still people in Chernovsky at the time of the war?
No.
Yeah.
No, they had all that there.
In the 1920s.
Yes.
Why did people abandon the villages?
Oh, there was a better place to live. I'd probably, Unalaska offered a better place than they did. They had there. And they had to depend on a mail boat that was kind of spasmodic. They might make it for 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
One time we went 6 months here without mail delivery, depending on a mail boat to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
How often did it come in? How often did the boats come in here at all in the winter?
Well, very seldom during the winter, but this mail boat was our source of supply as well as our mail delivery. And they were under the Fern was under a twice a month contract, bi-monthly. And the big supply boats would come in probably once a summer. And we'd stores would probably have to stock up a year's supply. That required quite a bit of thought to foresee the requirements of an annual supply for 200 or 300 people. And probably some of the stuff they ordered would be pretty bad by the time the end of the year.
How about eggs?
Well, some of it got pretty right.
When did you set up a store in Unalaska?
I bought Parley Arts. That was a degloss store in 1944.
What store?
Degloss. Yeah, degloss, I call it.
10 cent store, sort of thing.
No, it was probably pillow slips and ivory and.
Sort of a general trading post,
gifts.
Like.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What year did you
do? 1944. Then I was on this, I had this mail contract, and I went out in 1948. And since I had quite a number of prisoners to feed, I had a lot of food. Attic. And since the Alaska Commercial Company didn't have a good supply of some of the food, why they wanted to come and buy my groceries, so it was quite a bother. But then my wife said, well, we'll start a grocery store. And I said, no, nothing to do with that. Would be out of the question. So one day I came back and I had a grocery store, half of it. Half grocery and half gigaws. And then the next trip I had a grocery store. And that's the birth of the Aleutian Merchant, I guess they call it. I forget what I called it to begin with.
How long have you lived at Agnes Beach?
About 1951 or two.
Mm-hmm.
You said you had a lot of prisoners. Where did you get all the prisoners from? What?
Well, one time I had 29 parolees reporting to me. Men that were released from prison to come up and work in strategic war efforts. And they were the men that I had least trouble with, because I told them that if I had any trouble with them, why, that was it. I'd just report them back to the pen they'd go and go out for Simdrake Puget Sound Company, which would be Douglas, because Simdrake Puget Sound Company was on a cost-plus contract basis. Mm-hmm. And they made it cost plenty.
Are you still in business, this Puget Sound deal that you're talking about?
I understand.
Drake
is active, yes. But the rest of the contractors, it was a
What's this other story on Margaret Bay you're going to say? Tell us what to talk about.
Well, now that Margaret Bay, we had the herring industry here that was one of the outstanding things that probably goes down in history as one of the things that contribute to our economy. And I was engaged in that business with Ed Allen and another person. I don't remember his name yet. But anyway, our herring measured, the large, extra large, were 14 to 15 inches. And the large were 13 to 14 inches. Now that's a big fish. That's about so gross. And they were broad and deep. And they were full of Milton roe. Mm. And they spawned in Margaret Bay, or the lagoon in Margaret Bay that had eelgrass in it. And the Navy filled that with rock and gravel and eelgrass. And in 1946, it was the last year that I was able to put up herring. I was equipped to put up 3,000 barrels of herring, and I got 119 barrels. I had a crew of 11 people standing by, and I was on payroll, and I went to the wall, as well as the industry. That was the end of it. There hasn't been a herring packed here since, unless it was some of this bait stuff that was in the bay now. But the herring disappeared. We first came here in 1928, and it was sure an abundance of product.
If you were going to tell someone that was young that was going to move up here, say this year, what would you tell them to do?
Well, I'd tell them to get a job and take a good look at the place and study it, and then do what they wanted to do, because they've got their choice.
Except you couldn't be a logger.
Well, yes, you could. In fact, I've logged here.
Really, on the beaches.
On the beaches.